Coming up on Digital Music Trends, episode 202, on the 24th of September 2014, we discuss Beats Music's future as Apple denies rumors of a shutdown, Michelle Phan countersues Ultra Records, Ticketmaster acquires Sherpa.be and Eventjoy, the first battle won in the quest to ensure the pre-1972 masters are awarded performance royalties in the US, Splice goes into public beta, the Big Music Project and the Music Internships conundrum, bands and brands, and much more. This week's show is brought to you by Play MPE, providing secure music distribution and promotional services to the world's largest labels for over 10 years. Play MPE can be accessed on Windows and Mac computers, iOS, Android, and BlackBerry mobile devices. Find out more on plaympe.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli, and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And Digital Music Trends is available as a video show on YouTube, and you can also download the video. But if you like to consume the show on a desktop, for example, you can check it out on a variety of different streaming services. If you like to download it, you can get it on the podcast app or on iTunes. Now it's embedded in iOS 8, so if you haven't explored iOS 8 properly yet, you can actually go and check out the podcast app, and you'll find the Digital Music Trends right there. And I'm kind of wondering whether that's going to affect the number of people that subscribe on that channel, because before, of course, you had to go and install it separately. And this week, it's a real pleasure to welcome a couple of fantastic guests back on the show. And first of all, we have Jim Carroll, who writes about music and tech and both on the Irish Times, and has a fantastic blog there called On The Record. And you'll find the links in the show notes or by visiting irishtimes.com/blog/On The Record. So hi, Jim, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Thanks very much, Andrea. Good to be here.
We also have Chandler Coyle on the show, who is calling in from Chicago, from musicgeekservices.com. So hi, Chandler, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me back. It's going well here.
It's great to have you. And so just remind
Music Geek Services is a digital marketing agency, or we like to call a fan experience agency. Works with artists to plan digital campaigns, direct-to-fan campaigns. But I also do teaching through Berklee Online, which is Berklee College of Music's online extension. Awesome. I've been doing that for a couple of years.
That's fantastic. And Gemma, on your front, of course, is fairly self-explanatory. Anything that you've been doing that you were particularly excited about in the last few months?
What I've been doing the last couple of months is supposed to be taking a break from banter. I do a series of public talks and interviews called Banter, and we just took a break from that for a while because we did 30. Yeah, we were doing banter activities in the last couple of weeks. We were actually at Culture Tech in Derry last weekend. You were there before, Andrea. You were there last year. So we did some banters up there with Jimmy Bing, the publisher of Canongate, John Leyland from the New York Times, Hannah Donovan, the co-founder of This Is My Jam, and also Steve Carson from BBC Northern Ireland. So that went really, really well. So it's kind of, we're back in the banter saddle. And the On The Record blog continues to...
And so this week we have a couple of service announcements before we start with the news. So first up, I'd like to thank Play MPE for supporting the show over the past few weeks. The podcast would not have been possible without them. So visit plaympe.com to find out more about what they do. And second, I'm going away actually on a proper holiday for a couple of weeks. And so next week, I've scheduled an amazing pre-recorded show, which is going to be all on music product design. And for the week after, there was going to be an actual break. And so yes, that is correct. It's a break. And so if you want to check some of the older shows during that week, that'll be fantastic. And everything will resume as normal on the week of the 12th of October. So you should have a show out on the 16th. And I'm sure that while I'm away, there's going to be some huge breaking news coming out, like the launch of YouTube Music or a Spotify IPO. But that's just the way these things go. So not much I can do about that. And this week, we're going to start by talking about Apple once again. There was a report published by TechCrunch on Monday night that stated that according to several sources at Apple and around the company, Apple was going to move towards discontinuing Beats Music and essentially port that into iTunes, or essentially move some of the stuff around into different services of the company. And the report went on to remark that these statements were substantiated by the fact that there were absolutely no references to Beats Music during Apple's recent product keynote, and no Beats Music icons were displayed on the new iPhones or Store on the Apple Watch. Arguably, you could say that it's still very fresh, the acquisition, and probably Apple hasn't figured out what is going to happen with that. We've seen more reports afterwards. You know, Apple has denied this via their PR representative, and they said this is not true at all. We have heard other stories afterwards talking about the fact that there would be a relaunch of some sort of music services service in February, so in Q1 or Q2 of next year, which is going to go alongside iTunes or become part of iTunes. And so a lot of question marks on that front. Chandler, from a US perspective, since you actually have access to Beats Music, do you think that, what would that imply if Apple was to roll Beats Music into iTunes?
It's probably for a mainstream, from a mainstream level, it's probably a good idea.
Right.
I would say iTunes has, a much better brand recognition. And, from a Beats headphone perspective, there's that too. So it's interesting that they would just jettison the name, that's being talked about, even though they have the Beats brand. But when you think about it, Beats headphones are probably, although it's a big business, it's still not, I wouldn't consider it mainstream, at least not across all demographics. It's definitely skews younger or hipper. But I use Beats Music. I use Mog.
Yeah.
I used Mog on suggestion of people at Topspin, including Ian. And I've used Beats. And Beats, my favorite feature within Beats, and I hope it doesn't go away, is pretty much open the app and it suggests the playlists and a lazy listening mood.
Yeah.
You just hit play and you go about your workout or your work or whatever. But he's also in charge. Ian's also in charge of iTunes Radio now.
Exactly.
Which I've played around with, but just like Pandora, you'd get bored pretty quickly with radio situation as opposed to Beats.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of stories. Yeah. A lot
going
of theories.
Around. Yeah. It's been a confusing couple of days on that front. There's a lot of rumors, of course. There's sources that are unnamed, and we don't really know what's happening on that front. And of course, we also have the fact that there's a couple of other facts to take into account. A, the fact that Apple actually released the Beats Music app on the Apple TVs in the US,
right.
Which kind of would indicate that the brand wouldn't be retired. Of course, it wouldn't make sense to release a product just before you're going to retire a brand. And on the other side, you also saw the kind of how excited Apple still is about the iTunes brand and how they sort of portray that excitement by doing the partnership with U2 that was arguably successful, but also created a big backlash for the company. So, Jema, on your side, of course, from a territory that doesn't have Beats Music yet, does Apple need to incorporate a streaming service within iTunes to communicate that more easily to customers in Ireland, for example, or in the UK, or should it stick with Beats?
I think basically there's a couple of things here. First of all, nature abhors a vacuum. So if there's no clear news coming out and if PRs are spinning, well, basically we're going to go away and write a story you want to write anyway. Second of all, it's interesting. As Chandler was talking there about the incorporation of Beats into iTunes, I was thinking that you've got a situation here where you've got two monsters coming together. You've got the Beats monster, you've got the Apple monster. And you would kind of think, okay, who's going to take over? I mean, look, for example, with Three Mobile buying Telefonica, they've got the biggest checks. It's interesting. I mean, Beats has a certain recognition, especially in the headphone space, as Chandler kind of pointed out. But as you just pointed out, when Apple were bringing in U2 and giving them a large wad of cash for a really dodgy album, it was the iTunes kind of brand that was to the fore. So
yeah.
It's like, I'm kind of wondering. I mean, I personally kind of think that, I still use iTunes. iTunes, I mean, despite it being a spreadsheet, it's a great way of keeping music together. I'm still using an iPod Classic. When I was on holidays, I did a dog with that. I listen to it maybe every single day. It's a great piece of kit. And I think basically what needs to be done is, I think iTunes needs a bit of design love, I think it needs a bit of functionality love as well, because there's certain things that, as different versions have come in, they've dropped out certain kind of functionality that needs to be brought back. So I mean, maybe basically getting rid of the Beats Music thing and bringing it into iTunes will give them a chance just to concentrate on that and that alone, because otherwise you're going to have, you've got two rival camps. You've got Beats Music camp led by Jimmy and Dr. Dre, and then you've got the iTunes camp that doesn't really have a kind of a public champion as such with the same kind of high profile. I think Apple needs to kind of like, you know, whoever's in charge of Apple business development needs to kind of bring the boys together, give them a bit of a kicking and sort it out, because it doesn't do anyone any good. I mean, you're basically spending money on two separate marketing campaigns with two separate brands. Okay, they've got billions in cash, but like, you know, surely there's a bit of efficiency needed there in the marketplace. If they're going to concentrate on iTunes, well then, stick Beats In as iTunes Radio and take it from there.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of what I wrote in this week was the fact that Apple also needs to get a shift on, in the sense that they can't afford to wait that much longer. I mean, I know that Apple always waits until the market is relatively mature before it gets into it, but arguably, you know, the momentum that services like Spotify are getting is likely to run over, you know, iTunes in the long term if Apple doesn't do something relatively radical to shift the way the music is consumed by consumers. And so definitely something that we want to keep an eye on for the next few months. And also, you know, the other thing to bear in mind is that Beats Music hasn't launched internationally yet. And that's a big issue because, of course, iTunes is a huge international brand. And the other question mark would be, have they got the deals done to launch internationally? And if not, how long would it take for them to get those deals done? Because that's also going to play a big part in how that rollout happens in terms of announcement and in terms of you know, wider iTunes integration. As we've seen with iTunes Radio, they rolled out to the US first, right? And then to a few territories after that. And now it's becoming wider and wider. So yeah, an interesting story there, and we'll keep an eye on it. Of course, we don't want to talk too much about Apple. Although, Jim, I do want to ask your thoughts. We've talked about this like ad nauseum, but what was the thoughts of the Dublin community around the whole U2 saga?
Oh, well, you see, you said earlier on there that you were going on holidays and you kind of expected basically a Spotify IPO or something, like some big story to drop. I was on holidays in Ibiza, and I wasn't checking my phone, wasn't checking my email. But one day eventually I just picked up my phone to kind of like text someone, and I saw two things. One, there was some loads of missed calls from RT, the national broadcaster. I was going, what's that about? And I saw this kind of icon, you purchased music. And I was thinking, I've never purchased a tune from iTunes in my life. And there it was, E2 albums. That was my own impression. The first introduction to the U2 album. The views here in Dublin, I think basically we're in a situation with U2 now where they've lost the halo. You know, I mean, the reviews, right, aside from kind of like, I suppose, that there's certain camp followers who will always review U2 albums in a good way. And I think what's basically happening with U2 now is everything else is overshadowing it. The taxing is overshadowing it. The whole way they went about putting this album on 500 million iTunes library definitely went against them. And it's also the fact that the album is not very good. You know, I mean, this is really what it comes down to. I mean, in terms of relevance, U2 are no longer relevant, and they're also no longer making music which is relevant. They'll be relevant next year in terms of, like, I mean, Billboard and Pollstar charts, in terms of like high grossing tours and all that. That's fine, that's the business end of things, and that's all good. It'd be good for Guy Azeri's annual year bonus as well at Live Nation. But like, in terms of kind of like relevance to pop fans and relevance to music fans, it's not like that anymore. There's a lot of kind of like local media tattle about the fact that the album is based on their life on the north side, but like, you know, it's kind of one of those things that you got to remember that if you two are trying to get back to the way they were back in the late 70s on the north side of Dublin, they were back then, they were a very hungry band, they were very ambitious, they wanted to get away from this grey city. But like, I mean, they're trying to get back there right now, and they've got an all-star cast in the control room like, you know, helping them on the way. They didn't have that like back in the day, and like, you can't go back. You know, it's really, really hard to go back. And like, I just kind of think, like, while I admire them as artists trying to kind of like create these great statements all the time, their track record over the last decade when it comes to those statements is not very good.
Yeah, right. And of course, Chandler, do you have two cents on this? Of course, I don't want to leave you hanging there. If you have something that you want to say on the matter.
Well, with U2, for me, they sort of became like irrelevant back in 87. So I you know, I saw Joshua Tree. I mean, they were huge in my life. They came across through the screens and influenced bands I was in and influenced record buying, and we could look up to them. And in 87, they reached their peak. And after that, they put out good music, but they became sort of caricatures of themselves. So this sort of, you know, they jumped the shark of caricature ness of themselves, and you know, just they got the money, they got the payday, but yeah, I think they missed a big opportunity. To they could have given this to their fans first, almost sort of like unexpectedly,
right?
Said Apple, we're going to do it, and secretly rolled it out. But
Yeah, that's not how
crap.
That's not how you two roll anymore, Chandler. The idea of doing something totally surprise, like a Bowie or a Beyonce, they can't. They work in committee. Each one of them has got a personal assistant. Each one of those personal assistants has another personal assistant. Each one of those personal assistants has an entourage. That's how you two roll in 2014, unfortunately. And the idea of you two doing a kind of surprise album in the nature you've just described is just not on. It's not on. That's not. Right. They are addicted to the Big Bang, and they're addicted to two things. Actually, they're addicted to the Big Bang of kind of press, publicity, and profile, and they're also addicted, as you just kind of pointed out, Chandler, to the money. I mean, like me, Bono was insisting, "We got paid, great." Like, yeah. are you going to pay your taxes on that in Ireland or Holland or somewhere else? You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like it's just one of those things. I mean, dude, you're all about the money now. That's fine, but like, you know, stop going on about the music. You know,
I think
become a banker.
The single,
do more work with Elevation Partners.
I think the worst thing about it was the video that came out of it, because it was literally like it was an Apple commercial made into a YouTube video, and it was like the most bizarre mash of thing. It was just, I just couldn't deal with that at all. But moving away from that, because of course we talked about it so much on the show in the last few weeks, one big story that came out this week was the fact that we talked about it a few weeks ago, that Ultra Records sued Michelle Phan, the YouTube star, for the use of a bunch of tracks from the label, especially Cascade tracks, on her videos that have been on there for years. And of course, Michelle Phan has monetized those videos extensively, and she's made apparently over $5 million last year in revenues, which is amazing for a YouTube star. She's got endorsement deals with makeup brands, and if you don't know who she is, she does a lot of sort of how-tos for makeup videos and other types of sort of non-music content. And Michelle Phan has now countersued Ultra Records, in the countersuit she maintains that she did ask for permission to use Ultra songs back in 2009, and actually she reports a few conversations that she's had with the new media manager Jason Kilgore at Ultra, who responded by saying, "Really happy that you're supporting Cascade, and more than happy to let her use this content." There's a bunch of conversations reported around the fact that they actually talked about how they would get around the content ID issue, and at least in one occasion, Ultra has approved when YouTube flagged the use of the track. They actually approved that user so that the video could stay online. And from then on, of course, the relationship deteriorated in the last few months, ending up in Ultra requesting YouTube to take down the videos involved. She claims she has actually three different claims. First of all, that there was an implied consent for the use of the music. Second, that the takedown was issued in bad faith to YouTube. And third, that Ultra's bad faith was designed to disrupt her contractual relationship with YouTube in regards to the YouTube Partner Program. So an interesting case here, because we're seeing a label that has obviously had a hand in allowing her to use the music by essentially banking on the publicity. Of course, she was actually adding the iTunes links and the iTunes and the names of the track and the artist at the beginning of her videos. And the label, of course, was grateful for that, because even in 2009, she already had over a million subscribers or something along those lines. And so, you know, how do you see that shaping up as far as how the relationship between YouTube creators that have some traction and labels is gonna go forward? Is this representative in any way of what's to come, or is it just a one-off case that's not replicable in any way? Jim, what do you reckon?
I think we're basically going to see a lot more of these kind of cases. You know, I mean, you're citing there that she has the email correspondence with someone from Ultra. You know, there you go. You know, back then they obviously were kind of looking at that, kind of going, okay, this is a striking woman who's making these videos. It get a bit of attention. It's grand. It's fine. It's, as we say in Ireland, it's grand. You know, there's no need to worry about that. There's no contracts. You fast forward a couple of years, and this lady's a superstar, and she's making good money from YouTube on the back of this, and the label wants a slice of it, and that's all fine and well. It's all fine and well for labels to look for a slice of it. But in this case, they already gave they already gave this on the nod. You know, there was no contracts, whatever. They gave it on the nod. And like, I think what's going to happen is labels are going to be a lot more, two things. Labels are going to be a lot more cautious about this kind of thing in the future. Yeah. That's for obvious reasons. They're going to think, okay, what's this dude going to do with my music? You know, is this going to end up in a situation where they're going to be making loads of money on back of YouTube and we're not going to get a slice of this? you will also see labels being a bit more forensic about this. You know, they, like me, as things stands, like me, a lot of labels are earning very good money at the moment by hiring someone to look for what we call the money down the back of the sofa. You know, the money that they've kind of forgotten about the good times. It could be licensing from Brazil. It could be, you know, it could be kind of like me, third-party sales from Indonesia, wherever it is. Yeah. They begin to look at that. They will now begin to look at YouTube as well. They begin to look at the kind of like where their music has been used. Can they get a slice of this now retrospectively? So that would be interesting to look at. But then there's also, you know, I'm an optimist, so there's always an opportunity as well. I mean, like, you know, like, I'm sure there are labels who will look at rising YouTube stars, especially younger ones, especially kind of, you know, teenage kids who are doing those kind of like, you described earlier, the how to put on your makeup, or they're doing diaries or whatever. They're like, if I was a kind of a savvy label, which I no longer am or no longer ever was, if I was a savvy label, I'd be doing some talent scouting on that score. Who are these people? Can we approach them? Can we get them on board?
Yeah. And Chandler, from your perspective, do you think that, you know, Jim's right, you know, pointing out the fact that this is something that we might see carry on in the future? And what kind of advice would you give this, you know, your students on your course, or people that you're working with when it comes to placing songs on these kind of mediums that, of course, grant you a huge amount of publicity, but perhaps not much the monetary return unless there are, you know, some revenues coming out from iTunes?
Right. Well, in the situation, an artist is being asked to do this. At the time, the artist was in a weaker position, and this was a great opportunity. If they said, well, let's put a contract together, Michelle probably would have said, never mind.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, you know, these days you have to remember that if you put something online, it's going to live on for a long time. And so if she records a video with Cascade's music in the background, or, you know, as a bumper music or whatever, it's not going away. And if you get, you know, if the label suddenly gets in a stronger position, everything changes. So, but, you know, I think it's probably safer for Michelle Phan and the other YouTube stars is get it in writing, you know, beyond the, you get something. It's, you know, it shouldn't be in perpetuity.
Yeah.
You know, like, she shouldn't be able to continue to make new videos, but at the same time, once a video is made, that's like, you know, permission to cut a record and use a sample.
Yeah.
It's going to live on forever, and you can't issue a takedown notice.
Going from one lawsuit to another, actually, there was one bit of news that I wanted to just highlight because it came out yesterday, essentially, is that the Turtles, it's Flo and Eddie from the Turtles, actually won the case in California court on the pre-1972 sound recordings. Well, they didn't win it, but at least the judge has delivered broadcasters like SiriusXM in this particular case, but also Pandora, it could relate to. They should have paid the Turtles for pre-1972 sound recordings. Of course, the whole issue, we've talked about it on the show quite a bit with people that actually know what they're talking about, but essentially the whole issue is that when the copyright reform happened in 1972, they issued a master recording performance right that was coming from, they created essentially the copyright on master recordings on federal level. The issue is that essentially didn't, from the wording of the act, it didn't exist. It wasn't predated. So essentially, anything that was created before 1972 didn't have this protection. And so, companies like SiriusXM and Pandora had not paid the rights on those master recordings to Sound Exchange as of yet. And so, it's going to be really interesting to see how this continues. Of course, the ruling hasn't been made yet in terms of the actual damages. The plaintiffs are seeking $100 million in damages, which is a lot. And it's going to be interesting to see how that shapes the future of this kind of issue in the States. Chandler, I guess from your end, you probably heard quite a bit about this. And do you think we're going to see a flurry of lawsuits coming off from this?
It's still, I mean, we don't know what it means. I saw some people who know a lot more about this than I do say this is only the beginning.
Right.
You know, this. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, it felt like, to the artist community, it felt like finally someone, you know, gives us a win. So they you know, win the battle, but the war has just started in this area.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, it's difficult. It's unfortunate because, you know, you hear stories about older musicians struggling and not getting, you know, Flo and Eddie, the Turtles, lots of opportunity. And it's just, it's sure, that's the law and this is business and you're tough luck, kid. But, but you know, it just doesn't seem, you know, when you're trying to, Pandora's crying and saying, you know, trying to negotiate rate things, and SiriusXM and Pandora are benefiting by not paying people who, I mean, if you cut off pre-72, my wife is a huge fan of 60s music, as am I. I mean, that would be unfortunate if you couldn't stream, if they geo-blocked it. There was one article, I think it was the one you linked to, about they could just geo-block pre-72 music in California.
Right,
if
yeah.
That's, and just that would be ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that it must be weird. It must be kind of difficult on Pandora's and SiriusXM's position as well. So Pandora especially, because they are trying to sort of reach out. I read a piece on the Wall Street Journal with a CFO of Pandora, and they made a recent interesting hire from Epitaph, and they're trying to rebuild some bridges. They made a deal with Merlin. So they're trying to rebuild some bridges with the artist communities that perhaps were burned last week with some of the statements that came out. At the same time, I guess if, you know, the company is a business and they're trying to make money for the shareholders, if they felt like the legal requirement of the act essentially gave them a pass on paying these royalties on pre-72, as a business that has shareholders and everything else, it kind of makes sense that they would be fighting it, but that puts them completely at odds with the artist community.
Yeah.
And it also sort of showcases something that seems to make no sense at all. You know, the fact that from an arbitrary date onwards, you get paid, and from an arbitrary date and beforehand, you don't get paid. So I don't know, yeah. Jim, from an outsider's perspective, outside of the US, well, what do you reckon about this?
Well, the one thing I can't remember which one you said it, but you said it's something I just stopped my tracks straight away. You were saying that terms of looking for damages are $100 million.
Yeah.
Now, I'm racking my brain here trying to think my turtle songs I know. Now, they're not kind of like, I mean, they're probably very, very big, a big 60s band. I'm not really up on that. But I'm just thinking of all the other bands, all the other big 60s bands, all the other big bands who are caught in this. 100 million for the Turtles, multiply that by infinite number of 1960s bands, and it's by Pandora. You know, it's like you can see why Pandora will want to fight this, because otherwise it's going to create this a precedent which will cripple them and send them out of business. And then you can be sure that, like, you know, the guns will be turned on other services as well. You know, it's just like, it'll be interesting to see where it rolls. This is obviously the test case to see what's going to happen from here on in, you know. But, like, you know, again, it goes back to kind of almost like what we were talking about in the last, on the last kind of clip about YouTube and about like forensic accounting in a way. You know, we're going to see more and more of this when it comes to copyright, when it comes to, like, you know, especially when it comes to kind of like the accounting practices done by major labels back in the day. You know, that there will be lads who will go in there with the calculators and go through everything and, like, they just strip it right back down. It'd be like it'd be the biggest kind of like Inland Revenue or IRS audit of all times. You know, they'll just go in and go through absolutely everything and find the money.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it looks like, SiriusXM here is in trouble. But, you know, the implication, of course, we're talking about Pandora because that's probably the company that my listeners are more familiar with. But, you know, the implications of Pandora are the same because they are under the same license, essentially. And they would be violating the same public performance rights if the court establishes that the pre-1972 recordings, need to be paid for. And so, it's going to be an interesting few months on that. And I'm sure I'll get some more legal minds on the show to talk about that in the next few weeks.
Jason Feinberg on to talk about.
Yeah. I know that it's always a bit of a bumpy road when you first join a company. We're moving into a completely different topic, actually. I wanted to talk about Ticketmaster. This is a story that I actually earmarked the last week, and I didn't manage to talk about because we didn't have time. And so Live Nation-owned Ticketmaster made two acquisition announcements in the past couple of weeks. So the first of all, the company acquired the Belgian ticketing company Sherpa.be for an undisclosed sum, and Sherpa has a turnover of 55 million euros per year and about 20 people as staff. The company will be incorporated in the current Ticketmaster Belgium team. And second, Live Nation CEO Michael Rapino announced that they acquired the mobile ticketing platform EventJoy, and that was announced at an investors conference in New York about 10-12 days ago. EventJoy offers a mobile ticketing platform and analytics and social media marketing for do-it-yourself event organizers, as well as user tools and real-time notifications and venue maps on phones. And so this is a space that Ticketmaster, of course, wants to move into pretty fast, interestingly, because, of course, they are well known for their larger deals and not so much for their support of DIY artists. But there are other companies that are gaining ground on that front. Eventbrite being one of them, for example, that they're doing pretty well in the small gig space in North America. He just remarks essentially that there are no AOL Time Warner deals here, and that these are all small acquisitions, and Ticketmaster will continue to do these acquisitions going forward. So, Jim, you know, what you reckon about Ticketmaster continuing, to buy third-party ticketing companies, even as it is already a monster of a company, and how do you see them moving into this DIY space, given the incredible fees that they charge for tickets these days?
Well, it's like the ultimate game of Pac-Man when it comes to Ticketmaster and Live Nation. It's just gobble up everything in sight. This is the business model. This is how they operate. So, I mean, they're looking at, like you talked there about kind of DIY spaces and the small gig spaces. They're still selling tickets, Andrea. You've got to remember this. And like that's what Live Nation want, kind of a cut of that. They want a share of that. You know, and this is the model that, like me, Live Nation have been putting in place since SFX and Clear Channel days. Buy, expand, create everything, own the whole space, own every part of the space. And like, it's interesting that, like, you know, we're finally seeing some competition on the live music side. You know, we're finally seeing like people moving. For up to now, the tech space has always been looking at the records, chipping away at the records, hitting the records, going to the records all the time. And the last while, we've seen various kind of like companies identify weak spots in the live music sector and go for that. And ticketing is definitely one, because everyone hates Ticketmaster. Absolutely, everyone hates Ticketmaster. You know, my mother was buying tickets for a show down in Limerick, and she to deal with Ticketmaster around the box office. She now hates Ticketmaster as well, and she's never hated anyone in her life. So, like, anyone who has to engage with them doesn't like them. So, like, you know, you're kind of going like, well, if you don't like me, we're going to be as big as possible, so you can't ignore us anymore. So yeah. They will. Like, I mean, I think Eventbrite's amazing. We use Eventbrite for banter, and it's a great, great service. If they move to Ticketmaster, what we do? You know what we do? We wouldn't use Ticketmaster because, I mean, as you just said, the fees are too high. Like, we go off, we do something else. I mean, people involved with banter, there's a company called Bobby Tonic. They're involved in Till Tonic and Door Tonic, which are kind of like those kind of services. There's a company HQ over Dublin called Gigstarter, and they're also involved in this space. There's loads of companies moving into this space. At Ticketmaster, obviously kind of going like, okay, you know, these companies are only going to own maybe 5, maybe 8% of the market in total, but still 5, 8% of the market they're not getting, you know? And like, you know, it's like, I can see why Ticketmaster works for the big promoters and the big band. I mean, they get one daily a day, everything is on that, or they're just dealing with one check. As we know from kind of like from various court cases and the like, that Ticketmaster like to give out rebates to favorite promoters and give advances out left, right, and center. So, like, it's a good position to be in. But I think Ticketmaster's model is definitely is.
Yeah, and I mean, we can't really say that Ticketmaster are the only ones to do it. Eventim, which is a huge German company, do the same thing in terms of charges and fees. And so, you know, a lot of the bigger players play that game of.
The important thing to point out, Andrea, is that, like, I mean, worldwide, Ticketmaster are the whipping boy for all this. They're taking the brunt of all this. Yes, there are other companies involved in it, and kind of, I know, say, here in the Irish space, we've got this company called Ticketside, and it's like their line is, well, we're not Ticketmaster, but they're still charging fees and all that. But Ticketmaster are the whipping boys for all this, and they're taking the brunt of it, and they're the ones as well, like, in fairness to them as well, they're the ones that the artists are blaming as well. They're taking all the beatings on behalf of the artists. And
Chandler, so Ticketmaster equals Comcast in the ticketing space. You sort of everybody hates it, but nobody can actually do without it.
I mean, it's been 20 years. When did Pearl Jam have their issues with them? I mean, it's been over 20 years. We've been hating them, but, you know, that you can't fight City Hall. You know, they're there. You know, it's. I used to see, like, what I've noticed over the last couple of years is I would get sent a list of tour dates where I'd have to do something for ticketing for an artist, and there'd be 30 dates, and it would be Ticketmaster, 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 Ticketmaster. Now you're seeing all different kinds of ticket agencies. You know, so it's their competition is growing, but it's interesting. Ticketmaster is just a necessary evil, and the ticket fees sometimes are ridiculous, and especially as ticket prices rise, so do the fees if they're a percentage based. But you just pay them.
Yeah.
Even the smaller services, their fees are sometimes ridiculous. So I don't know. We can't live. I still remember the days of having to go to the Ticketron, the mall,
right,
and hope that there wasn't somebody at the other ticket printing place getting that seat you wanted. So this is much easier.
Yeah, I mean, I was just recalling as well how I used to go to, we had a record store in my town in Italy, and he was also acted as a ticket seller. So you'd, if you wanted tickets to a gig in Milan, you'd have to go to him and say, oh, get me two tickets. Archaic thing, way of doing it, pre-internet. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much easier. I used to work with a promoter in Dublin who promoted death metal gigs in Dublin. And how he promoted death metal gigs was really, really simple. You just take a tiny little card and you place it on the wall of one record shop only in town, saying, I don't know what band were coming, death metal superstars, whatever they were called, are playing McGonagall's. And you leave all the tickets there and you'd sell them in a day. You know, so right. you knew where the audience was. You just went straight to them.
Right. Yep. Exactly. And it's a very different way of doing things today, of course. But one thing I wanted to mention was the fact that WhoSampled released an Android app. So if you are an Android user and you like knowing who sampled who, then you might want to go and get WhoSampled on the Android. It's free, actually. So it's a different business model than the iOS version, which is £1.99 or $2.99. This is ad-based, of course, making possibly good use of the larger real estate of most Android devices. Although this might change with the new iOS devices if they don't bend too much. So WhoSampled, go and check it out on WhoSampled.com or go and find it on the Android store. It looks like a cool app. And actually, I've got an interview with the CEO on the DMT one-to-one show that's also coming out alongside this show. So if you are not subscribing to that, you can check out the DMT one-to-one on the podcast app and you'll find that there as well. And let's talk about another startup called Splice. So Splice is a new startup. They've been in a closed beta for about 10 months, and now they've finally opened up to their beta to everyone. I interviewed the company in Miami back in March, they were probably 3 or 4 months into the private beta. And essentially what they do is they allow musicians to synchronize their project data to the cloud on an ongoing basis so that it can be shared with others and used for collaborations. So they started out by supporting Ableton, but also they support Logic and the FL Studio right now. And the interesting thing here is that it's not just a tool for musicians to consume music and to find out how other people have created that piece of music. It's also an interesting new technology when it comes to the visualization of it. And we've seen over the years a bunch of different apps that allowed you to take stems and play with them and do different things. But what they do is that the project itself now is going to be visually available to people that want to play it, if you want to share it, of course, with the world. And people are going to be able to see essentially a grid system of all the different stems and instruments that you have on the track, and they're going to be able to mute them, play them individually, do different things with them, and sort of understand how the song is constructed that way. It looks very much like almost like a SoundCloud widget as far as the simplified waveform is concerned and the visual aspect of it, but underneath it there is a much bigger window that allows you to see all the different tracks and stems that are making up the song. So Chandler, are you excited about this, or what do you think about Splice?
I played with the player this morning. You know, they had that sample track with all, yep. I think it was 35 tracks, sample song with 35 tracks. I was blown away. You know, I was, although it's revolving around DJs and electronic music now, I was just imagining it's like a band that you had 10 years ago where everyone lives in different cities, and this, you know, just making it easier to collaborate or right. finish stuff in a cloud-based way. You can do that now with Dropbox and sending files around, but it's clumsy.
Yeah.
This is, you know, it's like, why didn't GarageBand think of this? This is something Apple could have Absolutely. Created a bunch of, I mean, people are complaining about too much music, you know, as it is, because everyone can make music, but I sat there this morning, you know, very early this morning with my jaw just hit the floor when I'm like, wow.
Yeah, it's cool. You know? It's cool. When they explained to me what they were trying to do with the player, I was like, wow, this is going to be awesome if it works, and it does work, it looks like. So
yeah.
It's going to be a case of how easy it is for people to publish this stuff.
Right.
Because the one they showed, of course, was a demo of the technology, and I'm really interested to see how the publishing process is going to work on the front. But they also raised $4.5 million on a Series mm-hmm. A round, so they're going to keep going for a while longer, and hopefully they're going to get a bunch of users, because I think, you know, the tech seems really good. They also do a backup service essentially for your projects, and so seems to make a lot of sense for musicians that do a lot of music on the go and might be traveling from place to place and collaborating with different people. Jim, did you feel like this could be, yet another way for people to be able to collaborate long distance and create some interesting stuff out of it?
Totally. It's one of those things that there's been a need for something like this for quite some time. That you've got an awful lot of kind of producers or musicians who are working on their own, maybe, that they've got a guitar, they're really, really good in guitar, they're looking for a string section or whatever. I can see this service moving into that kind of area, that you basically say, I need a string service. You maybe will be based in Dublin, Ireland, and you could find a string player in New York who'll play with you and collaborate on the track. However, as Chandler pointed out, just the publishing on this will be interesting. It's like, how's that going to work out? Say these people start collaborating on a track and it becomes a massive, massive hit. We all know where's a hit, there's a writ. So it's like, what's the publishing side in this? Where's that going to go? But I think as an actual tool, I was looking at it yesterday, and I was just kind of going like, okay, I'm not a musician, but like this solves that kind of problem. That if you're a bedroom producer and you want to, and you're a bit of a lot of musicians, as we know, are quite introverted and they're very antisocial and they're not exactly great with people, unfortunately. Like if they want to find some people, this is an ideal way of doing it. But like, again, it will be interesting to see if the problems occur, how they will be addressed.
Yeah, and the cool thing to point out as well, that if I understand things correctly and sort of I give it this go, it's essentially more like a Google Docs technology in a sense, because you can actually collaborate on a track at the same time, and the changes get saved in the cloud automatically. And so that's the interesting thing about it. It's not like you have to download the entire project and then work on it and then re-upload it. It's like the changes are being constantly updated a bit like if you had a Google Word document or something that you were working on online directly. And so that I think that's also a very exciting thing about it, that it just eliminates a lot of back and forth between collaborators that happens all the time. And so, very, very cool stuff. And, companies eking out, sort of their own space, creating their own space and providing features that bigger companies like, for example, Ableton haven't been able to come up with themselves. So we'll see what happens there and how many paid users they can actually garner through this, because of course that's a big draw of the company. And I think we should move on to talking about UK internships. So that's a bit of a niche thing that I wanted to cover, but essentially there's a lottery scheme called the Big Music Project. This was covered by CMU last week, and the UK lottery essentially funds a bunch of projects, and the Big Music Project is one of them. And now UK music companies are being encouraged to offer paid internships to young people considering a career in the industry, and this Big Music Project might actually just be able to help you if you have a company in the UK to cover up to 50% of an intern's wages on internships between 3 and 12 months. So this is a project that was announced following the crackdown on unpaid internships, which of course is a very bad thing that happens in our industry all the time, in the sense that it's people working for months and months full time without seeing a penny, essentially. And Jeff Ralston was quoted as saying, talented interns provide an injection of new blood, bright ideas, and fresh thinking into growing businesses. Through the Big Music Project, we're giving a helping hand to music companies across the UK to fulfill their potential and to invest in the future of the industry. And that's from the co-organizer of Big Music Project and the head of the BPI, Jeff Taylor. Chandler, do you wish you saw more stuff like this in the US? Is there any stuff like this happening? And how are people dealing with the whole intern issue over there?
But I wish I saw it, and I wished it was global, or I wish the U.S. had the same thing. I know we see Canadian bands getting grants from the government. We see, UK lottery funding music business internships. In the U.S., it's just like you're on your own. I think that the biggest struggle for small firms, even firms as big as Windish Agency, right, they can't afford to pay an intern. The arguments on some side is that the intern's not providing enough value to pay, or they're getting credit. The way they get by in the U.S. is you're getting credit for it. It's what do they call that? I can't remember. But it's just you're getting college credit. So that also sort of screws the people who are 23 and graduated from college. We have students that have bachelor's degrees and then come and get a certificate at Berkeley online, and they're like, maybe they work in a day job and they're like, I'd love to get in the industry. Is there an internship program? And companies won't hire someone who's 24 years old into a position. And, you know, some of the work, you know, the sad thing is music is based in New York and LA, yeah. Miami. Nashville's not that expensive, but all those cities are hugely expensive to live. But this would be wonderful. So, you know, if I have students all over the world. So when next time I have a UK student, I'm going to make sure that they're aware of this, because we get asked all the time, can you help me get an internship? And I said, I don't know of any available that aren't unpaid. And, you know, unpaid ones, it has to be a really valuable learning lesson with somebody reputable. You know, it's like, I know Emily White from Whitesmith, she does internships, and I imagine that you come out of there with just tons of knowledge, so that may be worth it. But I've heard other horror stories where interns were just basically glorified gophers.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I mean, and there, you know, you made a good point there. You know, for any listeners, I know there's a lot of students from around the UK that listen to the show. So if you are a student and you have seen a company that's perhaps a small or medium-sized that works in music and you would like to intern with them, you know, try and get in touch with them. You know, it might be that they're not offering an internship today because they don't have the funds to cover it. If you do point out that this scheme exists, they may actually be able to apply, and actually you can create an opportunity for yourself there. So, I think resourcefulness is definitely the number one thing in this industry, especially today. James, what's the situation in Ireland? Of course, you have some. It's an opportunity to talk about How Working Class Heroes, which is a great event that showcases new artists in Ireland. But as far as the business side of things is concerned, is there any help to get things going for a business starting out, or for interns that want to learn about the industry?
Not really. I mean, the only thing we have is a thing called JobBridge, and JobBridge is kind of like, what is it? It's a top-up payment for those who are on unemployment benefit or unemployment assistance who want to take up a job. Unpaid internships rule the roost. I mean, they're everywhere, and like as Chandler said, they are very unfair. I mean, I was talking about this in Derry at the weekend at Culture Tech, and like, I'm just thinking, if I was starting out now, you know, I couldn't afford to do this. It's not like I had rich parents or anything like that. I actually couldn't afford to do these unpaid internships, and it just seems to me that it's just become this incessant, totally part of the mix now. That when you finish college, when you finish school, that rather than getting a job, it's like you're on this intern program. It's cheap labor for employers. When it comes to the music industry, the music industry has always been. We know this. It's always been the home of low wages. You know, it really has. I mean, like when you start off, you know, it's funny. I remember working as a press officer in a major label in the late 1990s. I mean, someone recently got a much similar job, and the pay hasn't changed that much. You know, and that's 15 mm-hmm. years ago. You know, so it's like, I mean, music industry isn't somewhere where you're going to go and make lots of money at the very, very start. Maybe if you turn to a Jimmy Iovine or whoever, as you move up the ladder, then that's where the money is. But like in terms of start off, it's not great. And it's very hard. It's all very good for someone like me to kind of say, like, okay, you've got to stand up for yourself. You've got to, like me, make sure you get paid for your work. But it's a totally different matter if you're someone age between 18 and 22 looking for your first step on the ladder in the music industry. It's very hard to say no when someone's coming at you kind of going, come on, work for me. Can't pay your bills with experience, but unfortunately, there's no other solution right now. You know? And so when I hear about schemes coming in like the one you just described, Andrea, it's brilliant. It's absolutely great. It's what's needed. It needs to be not just sectoral.
It's definitely a very good scheme to have, and excited to see it take shape, and hopefully we'll see some good companies be able to take advantage of it as well. Finally, Jim, you had a couple of interesting articles. I'll give you a choice of two that you published that if you wanted to discuss them. So the first one was about a blurring of the lines between bands and brands, and the second one was about the arc of development of Hoosier and the power of a song development. So which one of the two do you feel more invested in that you want to have a chat about?
Let's take the bands and brands one, because I mean, I think that's very interesting. I suppose in terms of like it can be applied worldwide. You know, it's interesting to see so many brands move into this kind of space now. But it's also, you got to look at how they're doing it. You know, and every brand, like, look, who wants to get in the music space, looks at the Red Bull Music Academy and say, we want to be the Red Bull Music Academy.
Yeah,
they never will be, because they don't look at how the Red Bull Music Academy has worked. I remember being knowing about how that thing was kicking off in the late 1990s and just watching it grow. And it was slow and gradual and patient, always patient. It was an amazing thing, because 10 years into it, you're trying to you suddenly realize, hang on a second, Hudson Mohawk would come through here, Flying Lotus came through here, all these amazing electronic music juices came through this academy. Yeah. But The Academy was not publicizing this. It was incredible. It was a slow, steady, credible approach. And they've got integrity, they've got a great reputation, and they do things properly. I mean, their operation in New York last year was something else. I mean, they didn't hold back. It was a great operation. But like most brands want to get into that space, and they don't do it in a clever way. They just want to come in, have their banner everywhere, have their name all over, and don't realize that's wrong. And from the band's point of view as well, the bands will just take the money, because I mean, the band, a bit like Bono, just want to get paid. You know, there are some people moving into space that's interesting. Converse, what Converse has done with that studio in Brooklyn and in Boston, yeah. Like that's really interesting. That's a very good move. Then you've got in London, you've got the House of Vans venue, and you've also got that Jack Daniels thing up in Kings and Monarch, is it, in Camden? So yeah. you've got that going at the moment. So there are brands learning. What needs to be done is that there needs to be brand, like, I mean, there's probably a lot of enthusiastic brand managers out there, and they just need to be kind of given their head a little bit. They need to be kind of like told, okay, you can actually go along and do this properly. You can take your time and do it really, really well, because it benefits everyone in the end. I mean, like, I mean, Red Bull are now, you know, they're synonymous with music because of the Academy. But it's interesting. It's very interesting, though, in kind of in terms of money spent. You know, like you, all of us here would probably think, my God, Red Bull are spending an awful lot on stuff. I remember last year talking to one of the Red Bull honchos in New York, and he just said, we spend as much money on one Formula One practice round as we're spending on the entire Red Bull New York experience. I mean, to them, it's a bit like Apple and their stack of cash. You know, right. It's a spit in the ocean to spend $100 million on the U2 campaign. So, I mean, that's where Red Bull's head is at, you know? So, it's a very interesting thing. And I think over the next kind of 12 to 18 months, we are going to see a lot more savvy brands kind of like, I mean, decide, okay, we have to take a long-term approach. I mean, I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with a brand here in Ireland. And, like, you know, they were definitely talking the talk. They were, like, you know, they were looking at kind of like a look. They were talking a 3 to 5 year plan, which I thought was quite interesting. I'd never heard a brand talk in that kind of way before. So maybe it is finally getting through to brand managers and account executives that you do need to be patient. It all can't happen overnight.
Absolutely. The long-term involvement, I think, is key. And the interesting thing that I didn't know about Red Bull Music Academy until I went to Cologne's CEO Pop is the fact that the whole thing was kick-started by an agency. Essentially, the Red Bull went to an agency called Yalastar in Germany, and they said, look, this is something we want to work in. And they came up with the whole concept and sort of are still helping Red Bull run it. There was a keynote by Thorsten Schmidt.
Thorsten, yeah.
Yeah, and that was super interesting. I didn't know anything about it. I just thought it was an internal Red Bull project up until then.
Yeah. Torsten and Manu, like the people who've been behind since day one from the Red Bull side, I mean, they are huge music fans, but they're also, like me, they're very, very good, very strong characters, and they know what they want, you know. And you need people like that involved in the project who will basically, like me, deflect any sort of like criticism. I'm sure there's been times when Red Bull are kind of going, why exactly are we setting up a studio in Cape Town? Why are we doing this in Seattle? You know what I mean? What exactly is going on here? And like, you know, in fairness, you know, the results, you know, I mentioned Flying Lotus and Hudson Mohawk there. They're not household names, you know. So, but like, I mean, whole thing with the Academy was it's never going after household names. It's going after people who are making adventurous music.
Yeah, absolutely. Chandler, would you like to see a Red Bull Red Bull experience in Chicago? And how do you feel about this whole space? Are you seeing some interesting stuff happening your end?
Yeah, I think the thing that I notice about it is the difference between thinking of it as advertising or sponsorship versus partnership. And the key is, in Red Bull's case, it was partnership, it was long-term, it was music fans. I mean, essentially, if you got a ton of money and somebody comes to you and says, let's do this, and let's do this in perpetuity forever, then it's different than Pepsi or Doritos. If you've been to South by Southwest and seen the Doritos stage.
Yeah, we were both there.
That's not subtle, and that's, you know, you probably remember a time when concerts had a lot less branding around them. But, you know, I noticed with like Converse, I think, isn't the agency or the company that helps Converse with their music related stuff called Cornerstone or something? There's the people behind that are music. You know, the reason it works so well, similar to Red Bull, is that this similar people, it's music people. Yeah. You got to hope. The hope is that Apple, with the infusion of people like Ian Rogers, may, you know, veer from sponsorship and advertising to more music supporting, because that's what Red Bull is. I mean, I would love to see it. I would love, you know, if Red Bull opened venues in Chicago, or, you know, if bought the House of Blues and rebranded it, it would probably be a good thing. I mean, they've proven it. It's, you're right. Jim's article was great. As I was reading it, I'm just like, that's the difference. It's not that they're just subtle. It's that they're honest. They're authentic.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's not, it doesn't, I don't drink Red Bull a lot, but I'll, you know, you see the people drive around. We have Cooper Minis that are retrofitted as Red Bull, and you see someone giving away Red Bulls, you'll take one because, you know, it's a positive brand. You think of it as in a positive light. It's an energy drink that's giving back to the music.
And of course, industry. It helps if you have, like, you know, essentially bottomless, you know, bottomless funds to draw from to do
they're
this.
They're doing well. I mean, they're giving the music industry wings, you know, the artist's wings in multiple ways. But I mean, I remember Topspin was involved. Stage Black, you know, was even involved in Red Bull's label for a while. So they're you know, for the last 5 years that they've really, I guess, you know, got to the point where their bands are making them some money and getting some fame.
Yeah, exactly. And it's becoming, like Torsten was saying in the keynote in Cologne, it has become something they can now measure, whilst for a long time it was something that they couldn't measure, and they just had to trust that they were doing the right thing. And now they're actually starting to get metrics. And so, like, he was talking about stuff like, what was it? He's talking about some of the what happened in New York and the press mentions of Red Bull and of the Academy. There were, you know, ton of press mentions, even like seven or eight mentions in the New York Times, and they never had a mention in the New York Times before. So for them, it was definitely a win.
You couldn't ignore it in New York. They were absolutely everywhere. I mean, huge subway ads. I mean, they own New York. And what's really interesting is that, like, you know, that I suppose as a cynical hack, you kind of go, okay, how are the New York media, supposedly the most savvy, smart media in the world, are they going to be cynical about this? They didn't. They just kind of like drank the Kool-Aid. They drank the Red Bull. You know, they were all over it. You know, I found that to be quite interesting. And, like, you know, they were all over it because, again, as Chandler just said, they could actually see it was working. You know what I mean? They could actually see that this was something that was like, yeah, this is really, really interesting. And Cornerstone, they're an amazing agency. You know, they were involved with kind of a lot of the FC sound system, James Murphy's hookup with Nike back in the day as well. And, like, you know, they're a wise and savvy group.
Yeah.
And at this point I'm actually thirsty, so I think we should draw the show to a close. But but I might go and have a nice tea. I don't think I have a Red Bull in the house. You know, guys, it was such a pleasure having you on once again. And, you know, for Jim, again, it's on the record. The links are in the show notes, and you'll find them there. It's a great blog. If you have an RSS reader, I suggest you subscribe. And also, the Banter Sessions are available as a podcast as well, right?
Yeah, they're available now as a podcast. We've done about 26 of them as podcasts. If you go to thisisbanter.com/podcast, you'll get them there.
Awesome. So thisisbanter.com/podcast, and thoroughly recommended. I was absolutely captivated by some of the interviews you did at the Hard Working Class Heroes sessions last year. So,
thank you very much.
Chandler, for you, it's musicgeekservices.com, and anything else you want to plug?
I've just started a newsletter. I was sort of inspired by Darren's Daily Digest, and I have former students who wanted to stay in touch, and it's actually grown beyond that. It's called The Coil Report.
Awesome.
So it's thecoilreport.com or just coilreport.com. You can sign up. It started out as daily, and it's now I'm transitioning it to weekly, although half my subscribers like to hear from me every day. And it's just basically music marketing tips, mostly for the direct-to-fan, you know, DIY type artists, so artists focused.
Awesome, that's fantastic. And so I haven't actually subscribed myself yet, so I need to go on there and subscribe too. And it was a pleasure having you on once again. Thanks so much for listening to the show again. Next week it's going to be a pre-recorded show, but an unmissable one. We are going to look at some of the some fantastic tips and some great insight around designing music products and with two great designers. And so it's going to be it's a really fun show. Actually, I've already recorded it, so I can say that already, and and it's very visual, so I would recommend you actually watch the show rather than listen to it if you can, or you go back to the video, because we're actually showing some of the examples on the video itself while we go through them. And the week after is not going to be a show, and so we're going to resume on the 16th. Probably the next show is going to be live around the 16th of October. Thanks so much for listening again. It's digitalmusictrends.com.